I've written a lot of shows now, but whenever you finish writing something, whether it's an episode or a series or a comedy festival show, you're exhausted. It's kind of a little bit like some of you might feel now. You probably don't even want to think what the next thing is. But there is a moment when you do have to write the next thing. There is a moment when you open your laptop and you stare at the blank page. And it is the single most thrilling, terrifying thing, because you can put anything on it and you can tell any story you want. And for the last few years, you've all written a story for yourself. Some of you will have loved the story. Some of you might not have loved it. Some of you might just be glad that it's over. But when you started at school, you probably weren't in control of that story. Your parents might have chosen the school, or the teachers might have encouraged you to do subjects, or friends might have told you to do a particular subject. But now all of you have a blank page and you can fill it with any story you want. And it doesn't have to be perfect straight away. The first episode of the show that somebody mentioned before, Ronnie Cheng, International Student, had 32 different drafts, and I still look at it and still reckon it could be better. But the important thing is that you tell the story only you can tell and make it a story that you can be proud of.
And that's the voice of Declan Fay, who's my special guest today. Declan speaks in schools, and the school he was speaking in there was Eltham High for their valedictory speech night last year. And that will be the feature speech, but actually we're going to speak more generally about speaking to kids in schools. Declan's been doing it for more than 20 years, as have I. And there's a certain quality you have to stand in front of teenagers, adolescents, young adults, and make it entertaining and meaningful. And Declan's a master at it. So we're going to be talking a bit about that. Declan is a comedy writer extraordinaire. He wrote Crossbred. If you're going to listen to one ABC podcast this year, you have to listen to Crossbred. The premise of it is that two kids, played by Chris Ryan and Megan Washington, start a Christian rap group, but they aren't Christians. But it's a way of being popular in the music industry, and it is very funny. Crossbred, look that one up. He also co-presented The Sweetest Plum for many years with Chris Kennett, and he's written some great series, one being Ronnie Cheng, International Student, which he co-wrote with Ronnie, who was doing great things with The Daily Show. I've been looking for an excuse and a way to get Declan on this podcast. He's one of my favorite talkers and storytellers, has a knack for remembering beautiful detail in stories. And in some ways, the topic of this Speakola podcast should be how to talk in a podcast interview, because you can hear how well Declan is able to summon the anecdotes of his life. If you do like the Speakola podcast, you might like our newsletter, news.speakola.com. It is free to sign up, or you can pay, and that is $5 a month or $50 a year. Or you could contribute at Patreon if you want to keep Speakola up and running. I think we've got 199 generous contributors across the Substack newsletter and Patreon, and some people who just donate directly as well. And it's all very gratefully received. So thank you if you are involved in that. If you want to be our 200th, sign up at news.speakola.com or go through the speakola.com website, and there's a donations button. I don't have sponsors. It's just me doing the podcast, just me doing the newsletter. It's a solo operation. And I hope this whole Speakola endeavor might be worth $5 a month to you. Certainly this episode will be. It was such a pleasure to record with Declan. You only ever have to point him in the right direction and off he goes. And in this case, I think I've put in the preamble.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
If you lay down with dogs, you get fleas.
Fraud, sham, and hypocrisy. Change within the system.
The hollow man of anger and bitterness all must be left to a bygone age.
I understand victory. I understand sacrifice.
Speakola.
I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get to the promised land.
Speakola.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the government yet.
Speakola with Tony Wilson.
One testing, one two, check
testing.
One two.
Yep. One two.
Okay.
One two.
One two, one two.
I'm all good. And your red lights on?
My red lights are flying and we're good. Maybe turn down a little bit.
Have you ever lost a full one?
Early, I think I did.
Yeah. I believe it's the mark. You must do it to become a podcaster. And yeah. You must lose one of, in your mind, it's probably the greatest episode you ever did.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't believe you're a true podcaster until you've lost one.
Yeah, well, don't moz this one.
Oh, so yeah, right.
Yeah, what was that? Well, actually, I have lost one. I did have corruption of the card and that was on, can't remember.
I did it early with, oh, what's his name? Well-known comedian. Oh, my God. When I was at Triple R. Yeah. And I got the job, and I was on my own because Chris Kennett couldn't come, to go and interview Rich Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And he was known to be already a bit surly.
Yeah.
And he'd written a serious play about oil. And I got the job to go and interview him. And I was excited about it. I was like, yep, yeah, I'm ready for this. Got the mini disc player from Triple R that has the microphones with it. Go to his hotel. He wants to go outside so he can smoke. So already it's windy and blowing in the microphones. We start talking and he's just clearly, he either doesn't want to be doing it or he's just, and he's real angry. Not at me, just at the world and oil and power and the industry. But he's going for it. I'm thinking this is a great interview regardless of what happens. And then I look down and the mini disc player's dropped out. And I don't know when it did and I don't know. And all I did was just reach down and hit record from that point.
Yeah.
And because I was just like, there's no, I'm not going to tell him because he's gone.
Yeah. Well, how's this one? I went on Race Around the World to, we had this sort of last weekend, go and do your graduation piece.
Oh, yeah.
From film school. And then we're going to pick our eight to go. Mm. So there were 13 of us out there and choose your story around Sydney and beyond. I went to Canberra to do a story on Smokey Dawson, the country star. Yeah.
So this is before you got
on? This was to get picked.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I go and I do my first day's filming and it's this sort of romantic story of two 90-year-olds in the country music scene.
Yeah.
And then I get back to the hotel and whenever I've been lining up the shot, like, and then it cuts out. I've been stopping recording in order to record and then I've been starting recording when I stop.
Oh, no.
And so then you go, thanks, that was beautiful.
Thank you. Oh, no, don't. Oh.
And so I get to the hotel, look at that, and I burst into tears by myself and go, and then I ring up Smokey and Dot and say, just whatever we said today is entirely useless. It wasn't captured.
I'm getting so anxious. I'm actually getting a metallic taste in my mouth.
And so I think I'm now not going to be on this show. And Dot, 92 years old, 93 years old, said, let's come back and do it tomorrow.
Ah, superb.
And so we came back and I recorded it the next day and it's nice. It's a good little story.
And you got on.
Got on.
That small act of kindness.
Yes. Yeah. That's it. Well, all right. Let's think how I'm going to start this. All right. Well, I've been looking forward to this one. This is a person who I speak to regularly. We have many shared interests, and as soon as I see the name come up in the mobile phone display, I know I can set aside half an hour here for sure. One of my favourite people, one of my favourite storytellers, Declan Fay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tony. It is a genuine thrill to do this. I love speeches. I love, as you say, our interests. The Venn diagram of our interests almost becomes a whole circle. We kind of fall into that weird sport art category where neither industry quite knows how to approach us.
Well, I think sports writers tend to have a slight chip on the shoulder to say that the arts have rejected us, whereas perhaps sport is more willing to embrace artists. Ooh. I don't know.
You could do an entire podcast on this question. It's something I've wrestled with ever since high school because I remember I was on the cusp. I certainly wasn't one of the great footy players in the school. In fact, one of the only reasons I was kind of in contention for the first is I was this tall in year 12. And I played for Marcelin College. It was like Stephen Silvani had gone there and Gavin Brown, your mate, Greg Madigan. And we're in the generation afterwards where the school hadn't had a great amount of success. And I was right on the cusp of the first. I played all the
games leading up to the season. And in the last practice game, we played against our sister school, which was Sacred Heart, and they started me on the bench. And playing at full forward for the other team was Matthew Pavlich.
Ooh.
Yeah. And obviously they don't, but you knew the way everyone was like, Pavlich, he's going to be drafted. There'd been kind of the whisper was around about him. And our normal fullback, who was awesome, Carney, his surname was, usually great, just didn't have his measure. He was body on body, Carney, and he didn't have the pace to go with. Pavlich was just steaming out of the full forward.
Well, he's the greatest player for a whole AFL club has him as their best ever player. He's probably doing okay at year 12 level.
Yeah, well, he was to my memory, he may have actually been 1 year below us, I reckon, because he was still in year 11 and we were in year 12. Anyway, I just remember the coach looking at me, and ironically, the only reason I was on that trip, I hadn't made the original team, but I was the music captain, and they had to take the music captain on that trip. And so I had been told by the coach, bring your boots in case we need you. And so I remember he looked across at us, the coach, and he said, after Pavlich had kicked three very quickly, and it was on their home ground, it's full. I'd never been to a ground that had a grandstand that was full. Like, I'd never played on that before. And the coach looked, and he looked at the guy next to me, who was Chris Ryan, small utility, and he just wasn't the right guy to line up on him. And then he just goes, Deck, you're on. If you stuff it up, you're off.
And you were on Pavlich?
I was on Pavlich.
How long for?
I swear to God, I'm not overcooking this. I held him goalless to halftime. I went out there and I thought, I can't beat him with pace and I can't beat him with skill. I reckon I barely beat him body on body. But I just went out and I bumped him straight away. And then I'd watched When We Were Kings, the Ali movie, about can you get in their head? I swear I'd watched it that year.
Yeah.
And I thought, can I get in his head? And this is terrible. I don't advise this to younger footballers. I don't even think it's... And I started to say things like, I've been boarding with a girl from Sacred Heart. There's a lot of stories going around about you. Like, I know. I don't think it's... I'm not proud of it. I'm not... Nobody should do this. But what do you do? Like, you're exposed. And he's like, yeah, mate, good on you. I said, no, there's a lot of talk. And I just kept going. Even as I'm saying it, I don't feel... But next ball came down and he did the shrug off because he was annoyed, and I immediately get a free kick. And I get a free kick and I kind of won the first moral victory. And there is a photo. It's somewhere. I've tried to contact the kid to see it, of Pavlich and me in the goal square, and I kept resting my head on his shoulder. In the goal square, and it's a perfect shot. It looks like I'm kind of serene and resting on his shoulder. I held him and I remember coming in at half time, and the coach, he's a very well-known like VAFA coach now, Vaughan Cleary.
Yeah.
Vaughan Cleary said, he was congratulating people, and he goes, and I've just got to say, I didn't believe in him, but how good is Declan Fay? Sorry, I can see your levels maxing out.
Yeah.
And the charge, like, you get that clap in the room. And then I went out and I held him till the end of the third quarter, goalless again. And unfortunately then, we had a guy dropping back into the hole. The bloke had run up the ground. The hole was empty. Pavlich gets a mark, kicks one from like 50 out. Then he goes out again. I think he'd worked out lead out further. Like, don't go, you know, in the goal square. He gets a second one from 50 out. And the coach, he didn't lose complete faith. He moved me to the forward pocket. But he did move me as far away as possible. But we won the game by 3 points.
Well, I am going to retitle this podcast Interminable Footy Anecdotes from Yore.
I don't have any others. The only reason I bring that up is because it's that weird. I was going because of music. I get put into the footy team. But then when the actual season starts the next week, I remember the coach saying, and I knew I was on the edge, and we had a choice. And unfortunately, the school musical rehearsal fell on one of the nights of training. And I said, I can't do Tuesdays.
So music won. When you watched When We Were Kings, were you more James Brown, or were you more seeing Ali hit the heavy bag? What actually inspires you? That's the marker.
That is no. You know what it is? It's a remarkable question because I watched it a lot of times. I actually wrote an essay on it at uni. I loved all of it. I loved the music that they were playing. I loved James Brown. One of my favorite scenes in it is Matt Guitar Murphy from the Blues Brothers. Yes. He's in the band and he's in the background and they're jamming in like a hotel room in that weird 6-week period where Foreman is injured.
Yeah.
And King is just doing his, he's just riffing. It's like he has to keep them entertained for 6 weeks. And I won't do the accent, but he goes, we left Africa in shackles and chains, and now we return in an aura of scintillating beauty. And that
the man has swallowed a dictionary, Don King, hasn't he? He loves
really
the big words.
It really struck me because we didn't. I know, I knew he's shady, but I was going, oh, that's how that's the hype, and that's his. And you see Matt Guitar Murphy just nodding in the background.
Yeah.
But honestly, when I watch it, I'm not Ali, and I'm not James Brown. I watched it, and that is a very early moment that I fell in love with Norman Mailer.
Oh yeah,
George Plimpton, and the way they're talking about. I still remember Mailer doing his, and I haven't watched this for 20 years, but Ali hit him with a right hand lead, and he goes, "I don't think anyone had thrown a right hand lead at Foreman for 2 years." And it's like, what a specific thing to know—the authority and the passion—and then that shot at the end of that fight where I'm getting it. Look, the hairs have gone up. Yeah. The shot where it's Plimpton and Mailer.
Next to each other.
And they're holding each other like two little kids who've just seen the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
And it's just a frozen shot of them. It's a stunning that these guys were witnessing history, their love for it, their ability to articulate it. Completely different writers and came at it completely from different angles. And, you know, I then read Mailer's The Fight, which is, you know, a remarkable book.
And Plimpton's Three Lions or whatever. Is it called that? Papered Lion.
All of it. All of it's the ability of those guys to bring that. Because, yes, they had remarkable footage for at the time, but this is pre-mobile phones and the amount that they fill in with their words and their anecdotes and the heavy bag story, as you say.
And Ali Bumbaye was
Ali Bumbaye, the whole thing. But it's funny when you fall in love with a writer. It's like falling in love with a person. Like you fall in love with them for all these great things, but then you have to kind of accept the things that mightn't be as great about them. And Mailer and his inability to write anything vaguely kind of affectionate or sexual. And he won he won the award that they give out for worst sex writing for years. And there was some review, and this is one of my favorite writer anecdotes of all time. There was some review that Gore Vidal wrote about how bad Mailer's writing. This is 10, 20 years later, probably 10 years later. And Gore Vidal writes, you know, another kind of great American writer, wrote a review where he slams Mailer and says, terrible writing about sex, you know, it's comical, you know, I found it embarrassing, blah, 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 but very eloquently slams him. And then they're apparently at a New York literary party sometime in the next year. And Vidal's there and Mailer walks in and sees him and walks up and King hits Vidal and just floors him at this literary party. And everyone's like, and he's lying and Vidal's lying on the ground and everyone's like, are you okay? And he leaves a pause and he says, once again, words fail Norman Mailer. Now, if either of us ever have a line that good in the moment, someone did a deep dive on it to see is this true or is it just one that there is witnesses that this happened. Mailer would never talk about it afterwards, but it's just such a beautifully composed sentence. Once again, words fail Norman Mailer.
Well, one reason I've got you on, Declan, you did deliver a valedictory speech. I thought a beautiful valedictory speech for Eltham High last year, and that's what we're normally going to make our feature speech for this episode.
Oh, I thought you just wanted to talk to me about footy anecdotes when I was then dropped to the second from Marsland College. Yeah.
But in some respects, to hear you talk about when we were Kings and to hear you talk about your own Matthew Pavlich footy story, you seem to have this ability to remember.
Yeah.
Is that true? Have you got a better than average memory?
Yeah, I do. But as I say, for things that happened years ago, like, and this is not to go, oh, I'm a loser partner, or like, if my partner, Juanita, said, could you go and pick up you know, our 7-year-old half an hour early tomorrow. If I don't write it down, I'll forget. And I've investigated it a bit, and apparently your brain, this is what people have told me and stuff I've read. I even spoke to a woman that did her her master's in creativity and memory. And so apparently, for a start, your brain does lean. If you lean to the creative side, so the right side, then you're better at long term, because you remember pictures, but the creative, your brain allows you to join the dots between the pictures. And as you forget stuff, you can still fill in the gaps. Whereas if you're more the left side and technical, then you remember all the details, things like that. But then it's also, you're far more likely to remember things that have an emotional impact on you, like, because it kind of burns into your neurons more. And I don't know why, but I have a technicolor memory of childhood. My people like having me around because I remember stories about them from years ago. And I never planned it that way. And it alarms me how bad my short-term memory is. I write a list every day of what I have to do. Whereas when you just walked in, you know, before we were recording, I remembered a story you told me, you know, 10 years ago at a footy almanac publication night. So it's a weird thing. I remember things very... Yeah, I don't know. I just have a very... Like, I remember that Matthew Pavlich game. I remember things... It's kind of technicolor.
One skill I think you really do have is, it might be the Irish blood, the Catholic blood in you, Declan, but the ability to sort of tell a yarn. And we both do school visits. What do you think's your strength when you get in front of, you know, a potentially hostile group of year nines?
I have spoken to, not just potentially hostile, I've spoken to hostile groups. It's a weird thing. I got the job. I was going out with a girl at uni who was an actor, and she got this job to go and kind of talk at high schools about having a creative life. It was a program that was funded, and she got it through her agent. And then they said the program was going well, but they needed more speakers. And this was like 2002 or something. And she literally said, I know a guy that loves talking about himself. And I've always been, her name was Hannah, and I've always been incredibly grateful. Like, I think she said that with absolute, you know, kind of love, and she's right. And she'd already done it for a little bit. I don't know what the thing was in her mind that joined the dot that I would be good at it, but I went and met these people, and then the people that were running the program.
So was it booked out?
It wasn't booked out. I can say what it was. It was a very, it's kind of funny when I bring it up. So 2002, it was when school talks weren't as organized.
Yeah.
There's now kind of a bit of a, you know, an industry around it. And this was this very odd program run by a theater, odd but good, run by a theater company called Hit Productions that was out in Sandringham. And they would get private sponsorships, so people could go and speak in schools for free, and so the school wouldn't have to pay. So it was a good program, like they wanted kind of one of everyone. Like, so there was, my memory of that time, Lindley Frame spoke. She was actually excellent. She was really good. My friend Hannah Barry spoke about acting. She was awesome. Don Elgin, who was a Paralympian for Australia, he spoke. So they were all really good, but it was kind of like people from all different kind of backgrounds, but they didn't have a kind of like writer creative, and they liked the idea that I was doing comedy. But it was like the first or second year that I was doing comedy. Like, it was really, and I think they're like, no, you'll be fine. And the other weird thing about this program was the sponsorship they managed to get for the year that I was doing it was the two sponsorships. This is dead serious. Was Dolly Magazine, and it was Tampax. It was one of the like feminine hygiene products. And so at the end, if you spoke at a girls' school or a co-ed school, you would have to give a little bag that had a mini Dolly magazine in it and feminine hygiene products.
Yeah.
This is dead serious, but it meant schools could get it for free. And one of the schools that I was at early on, I handed out the thing. I did the talk and I handed out the things. And I'd forgotten this completely. We get a call later on. I get a call about a week later from the people running this program that said, we're not going to hand out the feminine hygiene products anymore. And I said, oh, what did I do something wrong? And because they told me, don't make a joke about that, you know, blah, blah. And I hadn't. And they said, no, you didn't do anything. But after you left, a bunch of like girls, probably guys, got the feminine hygiene products and jammed them into a toilet and then hit flush. And because they expanded, they exploded the toilet.
Yeah.
Which is just it was a lock that was going to happen. And so they pulled the pin on that. They just put a booklet out on feminine kind of health and stuff. And anyway, so it was an odd start, but I didn't know what I was doing. I was just lucky. There was a guy there called Paul Lacey who really believed in this program and I kept saying, I don't know if I'm right for this. And he kept saying, you'll be great, you'll be great. And then he just said, just talk about, and I said, but I haven't achieved anything. I'd done like maybe one comedy festival show, maybe two. And he kept saying, no, that's great. Like kids should see someone who's on their journey. And he just said, just tell your story at school and how it led to this kind of thing. And they were much shorter talks than you and I do. They were kind of 15 minutes. And you would just go up in front of an assembly, do a quick talk and come down. And I literally, it wasn't like you could go on YouTube then and see how people did TED Talks he just said, write the talk you would have wanted to hear when you were in year 12. And I thought, okay, I'll do a talk where, as I said, sporting art school. And we were always sport always won at our school. And we were always kind of made to feel like that footy training, like we had to apologize for doing arts. It wasn't like explicit, but it was like, you always felt like, oh, why are you doing that? Like, why wouldn't you want to be in the footy team? And so I wanted to write something that was, if you were an arty kid, that you would feel like, or if you're a kid that didn't quite feel like you fitted in at that school, that you would go, oh, maybe there's a path for me.
And what, there's always pressure when you're saying, oh, I've done the comedy festival the last couple of years and I'm up and coming as a comedian and I'm going to talk to you about school and progression. I presume you dredged that great memory of yours to try to have a story about you at school that they could relate to.
Yep.
What was your – did you have a go-to Marcelin College story that works in these school contexts?
Well, it took a while to find it. It took a while to find it because I did a few early on that – like they went okay, but they didn't quite land. And then I actually remember driving out to this school that was in like – I want to say Sunshine. It was in the western suburbs. If it wasn't Sunshine, it was St. Albans. And because, you know, you grow up in we weren't in a rich area. We were in like an area called Bulleen. Like we're kind of on the cusp of a more well-off area.
It's just cranes now, by the way.
Yeah, no, I drove through it. It is literally just a building site, which is perfect because every kid I knew became a builder in that area. So I remember driving out there and you've got all these misconceptions about, oh, it'll be rough and it'll be this and that. And it wasn't. I went out there and I think I forgot my notes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I forgot my notes. And I drove out there and then it wasn't like a big talk at an assembly. The librarian had organized it and she was in, it was just like a bunch of kids sitting on the floor of the library. And so I stopped doing it as such a big performed piece. And I kind of just went, oh, hey, just ask questions. Like, I think I just said, I've started working comedy. I'm doing radio at Triple R. And what their questions is what kind of made me go, oh, that's what kids want to know about. Like that's, and they would ask like, how did you get into it? When did you know you wanted to do this? And I was like, I just remember afterwards going, it was like it opened it up for me. And then I twigged like, they kept asking about, did you ever get into trouble or did you, it was the kind of moment that I needed. And so I thought about it. It's not in the talk that you heard.
No.
What I'm about to say, but I won't tell the whole thing, but me and another kid on a whim, we were both a bit upset at the school in year 10 and we stole a giant 10 kilogram block of chocolate and then sent a ransom note back to the school. It was meant to be for the school fundraiser. You know, those like cell blocks. And we stole it. And then I won't go through the whole story. My mum found out because she overheard us and then said, you're taking it back to the school now. And mum drove us back to the school and she was the getaway driver because we drove all the way back to the school. And when I remember the first time I tried to tell it because I thought, oh, that might work. And so I tried to tell it But I was too broad brushstroke. Like, I just went, I stole this block of chocolate and we got in trouble. But then at the end, every question the kids asked was about this block of chocolate. I could see the teacher getting agitated. This isn't at St. Albans. This is like down the track. But I was like, oh, okay, this is what they're interested in. And I was like, oh, they want the details of this because they're kind of imagining themselves. Yeah. And I just started to build it. I described my friend Luke, who was like, Luke was kind of the dodgy kid at school and you could dare Luke to do anything. And he was a good guy, but he kind of would have these sudden flashes of craziness. And so I kind of built him like a kid they would know. And it was all true. And then I was kind of like, we didn't quite fit in. And then there was this one moment where it all came to a head and we stole this block of chocolate. And I did the details. We ran out. Luke had it on his shoulder. We get home. What do we do with it? Should we get rid of it? Should we? No, let's send a ransom note. And the deeper you went into the details of it, you felt it just expand.
Yeah.
And it completely captured their imagination. But then I didn't have the lesson afterwards.
Yeah.
So first time I did it, the teacher was like, well, because that's all I got asked about. She's like, the teacher literally in the questions goes, well, how did you get from the stealing chocolate to what you're doing now?
Thank you, teacher. You might be building my future talk.
Yeah, and it wasn't, the teacher wasn't even being an asshole. It was like the teacher's going, hey, you're meant to be a motivational, so we're not going to let you go without, I can't remember what I said in the moment, but I remember driving home going, okay, how did that change? And I remembered that at the end of that year, we'd been in a PE class. And this is always my thing, this weird thing with sport and art. And I still struggle with it. And I remembered that this particular teacher, I don't tell this bit, but this, he would always come in with black eyes. His name was Mr. Zappa and he played amateur football.
Yeah.
And he'd always come in with black eyes because he'd be kind of hit on the weekend. I remember he came in once with two black eyes.
Yeah.
And this Lebanese kid in the class, Daniel Katamani, who's still to this day one of the funniest kids I've ever met, opens with, as the teacher walks in, sir, did your wife bash you? The teacher just goes, Daniel, out. And then what I loved about those guys, it was a very, Marcin Coates was a very Greek, Italian, Lebanese school, just their charisma. If that was me, all right, I'll leave. But this kid was like, sir, I'm just concerned for your welfare. and the teacher's going, out, out. And he goes, sir, well, I care for you. He just kept going.
Yeah.
Just ask a question, sir. I'm worried. He just kept going. And those guys were, and so I started to talk about him in the talk. But I remember that in this PE class with Mr. Zappa, how do I even explain it? Okay, let me go back one step. I remembered that I had, when I got really angry that year and felt like I didn't, things weren't going well, I remember getting frustrated and I basically wrote a kind of rant about it that it was kind of a poem. It was just a stream of consciousness thing. Then I showed it to a teacher and the teacher entered it into a competition and I forgot all about it. And then right at the end of that year, on the last assembly of the year, they announced they'd forgotten to hand, that somehow the message hadn't gotten through. And they said, Declan Fay got highly commended in this poetry competition at a sporting school. Every kid turns around it's kind of you're not from round here, boy. But it was this weird moment of oh fuck, what are they going to hate me? But also pride. It was this very odd moment. And having said all of this, schools are way better at absorbing the arts now, not so much then. And then we had a class after that, and it was a PE class because it was the last day of school, and everybody started to muck around in this class. And this is the story that I started to tell. We're in a PE class, and people start throwing shit everywhere, and it's getting louder. And this one kid goes to throw an apple, and it slipped out of his hand and hit the fan. And so the apple goes everywhere, which just was like the spark to the gas in that room. My mate grabs a ham sandwich, throws it at the fan. Everybody's mucking around. And then I think he was just looking to change the energy. I don't know why, or maybe, I don't know. I don't exactly know what went through his head, but he said he barreled us all. And then there was 10 minutes to the bell. And he goes, Mr. Fate, and he goes, go and get your poem. I swear to God. And
Mr. Fay, go and get your poem at Marcelin College.
Yeah, I swear to God. I remember it distinctly, and I left and I went to my locker. It wasn't that far away, and I came back. I was clutching it because it was stapled to the certificate they gave me. And so I go in and I read it, and I expected everyone to have a go, but they didn't. They just kind of listened, and then a couple of them clapped at the end. It was this weird, like, and then kind of the bell went, and then he goes, "All right, you everybody go." And then he looked at me and he goes, "Mr. Faye, stay back." Everybody leaves, and then he just said, like, he said, "That's the first time I've seen you, like, actually make an effort this year." And he goes, "You've pissed around in this class for the whole year." And he goes, that's the first time I've ever seen you try and extend yourself." And he said, "And you bring that on the last day." And he goes, "I'm actually kind of disappointed that I didn't see that." He was kind of doing it in, like, you know, it was very sporty bloke, and it, but yeah, I could tell that he cared. And he goes, "I don't write poems," or "I don't," but he goes, "Don't get to the end of your time here and don't waste this talent." And he goes, "Don't get to the end of your time here and wonder what if."
Yeah.
And that was kind of it. And that was the story I went back to tell. And I kind of had, like, "Oh, here's the dodgy kid stealing blocks of chocolate, and here's the moment that changed it, the don't wonder what if." And that became the talk that I did. I've done different versions of that thing. Sometimes I do a kind of shorter version of it, and I don't, but it, I've done different versions over time, but that's the thrust of the story, and that became the theme. And maybe for the next 10, 15 years, that was the theme. Don't wonder what if.
And with comedy and getting started in comedy, what's the first step? You know, if I look at my creative life being born, it's the decision to probably to write the mid-year review at the law firm. You know, I go, "Oh, actually, I can do this. I like this." What's your one?
I don't think I realized the first steps that happened. I think little steps happened to me and I didn't realize they were happening. I just joined the school musical, as I said. Like, I didn't have some, "I want to be in a musical." I just joined it because I thought, so there was that step. Then I remember, but you know, I wasn't conscious that that's a step. If there was a step beforehand, I was learning guitar at that school. No, it was drums. I was learning drums, I think, at that school. And I always liked the private music teachers because they came from outside the school. They kind of looked a bit more kind of interesting, and they kind of seemed a bit shady. And no, I shouldn't say shady. They just, they had a bit of edge to them. And I always kind of really liked them. I was very intrigued by them. And I just remember coming in, and I'd come from a class, something had happened, and I told the private music teacher, his name was Darren Perkins, he became one of my kind of friends and mentors, and I told him this story about what had happened in the class, and he just started cracking up. And I remember he said, he goes, "Mate, whatever," he goes, "keep playing the drums, it's great." And he goes, "You should just be a comedian." And no one, I had never had that thought before. And then, of course, you go and tell your mates at lunch, and, like, the most negative fucking idiot is like, "Oh, what? Yeah, you're going to be a comedian." Oh, you know, but it really stuck what this guy said. Like, it planted the seed, I reckon. But I never quite knew how that seed was going to grow. And then if there's a moment, I do mention it in the talk, it was being at Melbourne. Well, there was two steps. One was I'd go to Melbourne Uni, and a friend said, "Hey, my brother's in this show," and I didn't know what the show was, and he said, "Do you want to come along?" And I was just looking for something to do early at uni, like, "Oh, okay, yeah, sure." And it turned out to be the Melbourne Uni Law Review, and I remember watching them on the stage and just going, "Oh my god, this is the," I was just laughing. Like, I'd seen comedy on TV and I'd always watched comedy and I loved, like, Monty Python's and the Young Ones, but I don't know that I'd ever seen, like, just people doing it on a stage. It sounds weird, but I don't know if I'd ever seen that. Like, I'd seen musicals and stuff, but it was dudes that kind of looked a few years older than us, and something about, and they were just dressed in jeans, and there was something like, "Oh, that's not that far from me." And it wasn't perfect, but that kind of helped. And I just waited afterwards, and I said to the guy, I waited for the guy's brother, and I said, "How do I do this?" And he said, "They have auditions every 6 months, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "You'll find out when it's on, and there'll be posters up." And then, as I say in the talk, I see a poster one day that just said, "Do you think you're funny?" And I thought, "Oh, that's the show." And I auditioned for it, and I got in. And I Yeah, the bit I don't tell and talk because I only had a very short space of time. I didn't actually get in the first time that I went, but I wasn't very good the first. Like I was too nervous, too self-conscious. But it's like it was kind of like a practice match. Like I just had to learn, like, oh, that's how you don't do it, kind of thing. And then I went back the following year and got in, and that was the beginning. Because it's like now you get to write it, you get to be in it, you get to create it. And it was also the beginning of where I realized I could write stuff on my own, but I always loved that you would write. Some people would write it and go, you can't change a word. This is my fucking masterpiece. But I was genuinely the opposite of that. I loved that I would write an idea and then everybody would kind of turn it into something bigger. Or I liked working with someone else. So it was that was where the kind of the tree of comedy grew. But it was also where I went, I just like working with people.
And you're really good at that. Like Ronnie Chang, international student.
Yep.
You spot Ronnie as an incredibly talented man who's going to go on a trajectory I'm sure you couldn't have even imagined at the moment you became mates with him.
He actually spotted me. That was the weird reverse. I worked on he was in a sketch show that I was that I was the head writer for called Problems. And I know he was in it, but I was like, this guy's really funny. He is distinct. He has his own voice. This guy's really funny. But we'd kind of written stuff that maybe wasn't quite in his voice. And I realized, hey, while we're not shooting, let's try and get it more into his voice. Because I was just like, don't give him our words to say. He's kind of funnier than us. Like,
yeah.
And then that I started to work with him. But that show ended. It went to air and it was fine. Sam Simmons was in it and Dave Quirk. It was a lot of people who were kind of at the beginning. It's on ABC. I think you can still see it on YouTube. Claudia O'Doherty was in it.
What's it called?
Problems. Yeah. Kate McCartney was in it. Like it was, they kind of picked it really. Anthony Morgan was in it. Like Lawrence Mooney. They were these two surly guys sitting on their porch, kind of talking, sitting on their front lawn. Kind of, we called them like the Greek gods of the suburbs. But it was where I first connected with Ronnie, but I didn't, that was kind of it. I didn't, and then about a year later, he rang me and he said, I want to do a bit more storytelling in the next show. And he goes, I know you're good at helping people kind of develop that. And that's where we started working. I directed that show with him and we worked together. And that's where it just something clicked between us. He made me laugh. He made me laugh, just random things he would say. And
well, I was listening to your Willosophy episode, yeah, which is a gem. I really highly recommend it. I've done it as well. It's a really you have to be quite vulnerable in Willosophy, talking about, you know, what you think of death and life, yeah, and marriage, yeah, and love, and all these things tend to come up. And, yeah, and I think yours is really one of the outstanding episodes.
Yeah.
But one of the lighter parts of it is actually just you and Ronnie getting together for this show. And he really was an international student.
Yeah, he was.
And he took you on a tour around the city, is that right?
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. You're right. So there was a few things. There was probably three steps to it. And this is not me taking any responsibility for it. This is Ronnie was already on a path that he was going to... He was gonna break. Like, and it was a combination of an extremely unique voice that nobody, and I don't mean his voice and how he speaks. I mean it's that, but it's also his comedic voice, like how he sees the world, the lens through which he sees things and reflects the world. And he would just say shit and it would just make me laugh. Yeah. Like even now he rings up randomly. I've tried to avoid to this point doing the voice, but I'll just do it and get out of the way. Yeah. He'd noticed that I posted something. This is in the last like few months. He noticed that I posted something. My kids go to a school where it's bilingual. They teach them Spanish just down the road. And I get a video call from him and he's walking from a gig at the Comedy Cellar in New York. It's morning here. And he rings up. And this is why I think he's hilarious. Like, I don't know. He just makes me laugh out loud. He just rings up and he goes, and he's walking down a street in the West Village. And he just goes, why you teach your kids Spanish, man? And I go, well, the school teaches Spanish. That's part of the curriculum. And he goes, teach your kid Chinese. It's a competitive advantage. And I go, no, but and he goes, why you teach your kid Spanish? And I go, I don't. It's just part of it. And he just goes, what's your kid going to do with Spanish? If your kid ends up in South America, something has gone wrong. And dude, I was in my car, like just having dropped off the kids, and he just goes, okay, I got gig, I got to go, bye. And he just goes. And I was like, what do I do with that? Like, what do I, but I was just crying with laughter. And that's the key. He made me laugh. Like, you know, that should be the first thing when you work with someone. Do they make you laugh? That's the, yeah.
And it's interesting to think, I mean, he's such a stand-up and such a performer as well. Mm. But and I've watched you and known you from way back in the Triple R days. And I know that you did your own stand-up at comedy festivals in the early 2000s. And in more recent times...
I inflicted some shows on people, yeah.
And in more recent times, as you say, you've been a person that has guided shows along, has either been the producer, been the co-writer.
Yeah.
What was the decision in relation to performance? What made you more comfortable, say, giving that valedictory speech than it would be standing up at the Comedy Store Room in New York?
So we did... I worked with Chris Kennett, who was at Triple R as well, and another guy, and we did a show on Triple R for years, and I we worked with another guy called Chris Mildren, who was kind of our musician and would write with us and perform. But and we do the comedy festivals, and we had one that went really, really well in 2003. We came like runner up for the best newcomer to Flight of the Conchords, which if you're gonna lose, you might as well lose to, you know, blokes that go on to play stadiums. And but I just always it was the performing side of it. I didn't love it as much as sitting in a room, like collaborating with someone. I would just, it's not that I was like a nervous wreck or something. Like I could always perform, but I just would kind of get a bit, I just felt it didn't come that naturally to me. And radio certainly does. There's something about it that, I don't know, it just suits me because it's two people having a chat and podcasts. But the actual performing at a festival, like my theory is, as having worked with lots of comedians, my theory is that your joy has to just override the dread. And I remember one night, there was a few steps to it, but I remember one night playing a bad gig, and it was, you know, I started at the same time as like Michael Chamberlain and Charlie Pickering and lots of other, Justin Hamilton, like lots of other people around that kind of time who went on to be, you know, kind of comics and writers. And I remember there was this particularly bad night where we all bombed. It was just one of those nights. Not anyone's fault. It's just weird energy in the room. Not many people. It was a hot night. And everyone was sitting around afterwards, and I could see on the other guys' faces, they still loved it. Like they really loved it. And they were like, oh yeah, but you know, you could do this and you could do that. And I was just like, I just didn't love it as much as them. And it's not like, you know, it's not some like weak thing where I had to run out. I just was like, you would just see how much these guys still loved it and they were just reveling in it. And they were immediately looking forward to the next gig. Yeah. 'Cause I never want to do this again.
But you love the art.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I really do. And I love working with someone. Like if I'm going to work with someone tomorrow and we're going to go and write something, I'll look forward to it the whole way in. But whereas with a gig, I would just be driving there going, I hope a tire blows out. I don't have to do this gig. And it wasn't some like terror, like I'll still host something now or give that speech. It was just like, I'm not sure that I've got the, I'm not sure that I want to do this. You have to love this to do it. And then if there was a tipping point, I remember I was still doing it through 2006. So I've been doing festivals and solo stand-up and working in this group. And then in early 2007, I had a gig booked, and it was at a place called Local Laughs, which is still around and is one of the best comedy nights. I had a gig booked there, and it was the first day that I had a trial at Rove to be a writer at Rove. And I was just so excited about this trial day and was like, oh, we could do this and we could do... I probably annoyed the other writers for how much... Like, I just felt like I finally get to suggest stuff that might be on TV. And then it was like every time I thought of the gig, I was just like, I don't want to do this gig. But I loved that we were all writing in a room. And it was that thing. And then I had to go and do the gig. And the gig was fine. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't... But the thing I kept thinking about was I loved just writing in that room with everybody. It was just a feeling thing. Like I've thought about it a lot. And even when I was a kid, our school had a basketball team, and they needed, you could play, but they wanted players to like coach some of the younger guys. And I remember saying, can you just coach but not play? And I think I just, something about it, and I did. And then it's like, I teach students now who do like stand-up comedy, and I still hear stories about their gigs and I'm fascinated by them, but I don't want to do it. Yeah. Like, it's not, yeah, it's, I just, whereas weirdly, working with Ronnie on International Student, and you know, you're doing a shoot, you got to be there at 6 a.m. and be there for 12 hours, and maybe it's raining and you got to change a scene. And I kind of love that. Like, I just love the art of the creation and creating something from nothing. You know?
We had Julia Zemiro and Brian Nankervis on an earlier episode talking about the art of being an MC. Mm. And it is interesting that you do something like that valedictory speech or your regular speech in schools.
Mm. Yeah.
And it is quite different. How would you describe the different level of anxiety or nerves or whatever stand-up comedians have to specifically have yeah. versus what you and I have to have?
It's a very good question. I heard Jon Stewart speak about his stand-up career once, and that he didn't love it. Like, he loved that he'd done stand-up and he'd gotten better at it, and it certainly helped him when he got to The Daily Show. But it may be one interview, so I don't know if this is a thing he always talks about. But he said he wanted to be a stand-up, moved to New York, and he goes, and then I sucked for 2 years. And he said, and you have to, because you have to work out everything that doesn't work to kind of work out what does work and how your voice works. And then he met a girl and she suggested he should join she joined an improv group, and he was in love with her, and he joined the improv group. And he goes, that was where it opened up. Because I was like, oh, you can write material, but you can also learn skills to make something out of nothing. And then the woman said, and this really stood out to me, she said, how do you perceive the difference between the you that was, you know, stand-up and impro? And he said, when I did impro, what I liked is you're dealing with energy that's already there. Somebody's doing a character and you've got to take that, you know, then you've got to add something to that. It's like, you know, they talk about you've been given the offer and, you know, yes and he said there was something about that I really liked. And he said, I've always tried, and he said, I felt kind of free in that. And he said, that's helped me immensely when I started to have to interview people, because it's not about blocking, it's about, you know, keeping the energy going. And he said, it's almost like you're kind of like on a busy street and you're directing cars that are moving. And he said, but for stand-up, he goes, at that time I felt like the cars are already like jammed up in a traffic jam and the energy stopped when you come on and you have to then kind of get the cars moving again. And he said, I don't necessarily think that's exactly... He said, I think it's changed my relation to it over time. He said, but that's how I felt at the time.
Because there are 60 jokes that are written, right? And you got to... Yeah. Smash yeah. them out and yeah. and somehow make them sound like you're telling them for the first
yeah.
time.
Yeah, but- and you have to... It's, I mean, Will... Yeah, years later, I was talking to Will Anderson at a gig and I was asking him about that, and he said, yeah, and he goes, but I see it. He goes, I don't see it like that. I see it like waves and you're surfing. And he goes, there might be a big wave, you know, the great crowd energy might be... And so you have to... you have your material, but you adjust your surfing to that wave. And then he said... But there might be a smaller crowd, you know, something's happened in the room, or maybe the person before you hasn't gone that well, or whatever, you know, a thousand different things. And then you adjust your surfing for the small waves. Yeah, you're not okay. going to catch a half pipe. And that was, I liked that. I liked that analogy. The thing we mentioned, Jon Stewart, can I tell you I met Jon Stewart story?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was very early when I went to the US to finish writing the international pilot, a student pilot with Ronnie, because we'd written it, but we needed to put in one more draft. And in the middle, he got the Daily Show job. And it's like, well, I'll just, before he starts on the Daily Show, I'll go over there and we'll finish this draft. And it was the best thing that could have happened, because it was a new energy. There was this excitement. It's New York. Like, it kind of infused that second draft with so much energy yeah. in the script. And it was great. Like, it was just such a stroke of luck. So on one of the nights, I said, can we go and see the Comedy Cellar? And this is like, Ronnie hasn't started doing the Daily Show yet. He was going to the office in the day and we were writing at night, but he hadn't started yet. He's like, yeah, sure. I'm not going to do Ronnie's voice in this bit. But we go in and, you know, it's so mythical and you've seen people perform at it and I was like, oh my God, we're walking, you know, there's the steps, but there's the bar that's like up on street level. There's the... the gig downstairs, but there's the bar on street level, and there wasn't a gig yet. It hadn't started. And so I was like, Ronnie doesn't drink or anything. I said, oh, let's just have one. You know, I'll just have a beer in there. And so we go in, and then there's a comics table in the corner, and the only people that can sit on it are comedians that are on that night. And that's it. Partners, managers, no one else can sit on it. And as we go in, there's a guy at the table who recognizes Ronnie from some, he'd seen him on a YouTube clip. He goes, oh, you're Ronnie Cheng. And he goes, I love your stuff. I heard you're on The Daily Show. Like, it was just this kind of great little moment where like, oh, his life's about to kind of change. And then the guy goes, oh, my God. He goes, you should come over. John Stewart's on the table. He's performing tonight. And sure enough, it was John Stewart post-Daily Show, him finishing up on The Daily Show. And he had that big white
big
beard.
I remember the beard.
Yeah. So we go over to the table and John Stewart is just immediately the most lovely guy. And he goes, hey, Ronnie, you're on the show. And he goes, it's great, man. I can't wait. I'm like, because I think he's still an EP. He was still an EP of the show. He's like, I'm so happy to meet you. It's great. And then, like, you just know that John Stewart loved this show. And I was just standing there as the odd plus one to the side and, like, wedged against the wall where this table is. And he's like, hey, do they still do, like, Taco Tuesday there? And Ronnie's like, yeah, I think so. I think. And he goes, I started that. Like, and he goes, it was the thing for the writers. And then Ronnie, to his credit, like, he didn't just goes, hey, this is my friend Declan. We're just writing a pilot together. And then John Stewart just goes, hey, Declan, you're a writer. Like, really good guy. But yeah. I don't ever really worry about celebrity, but if it's someone you have watched and look up to,
yeah,
I really kind of froze in that moment. I was like, what are you saying? I was like, yeah, I'm writing, yeah. And then it was this such an awkward moment because the guy who'd pulled Ronnie over the table pulls him away and starts to try to convince him to do a gig that night.
Yeah.
I hear him go, I'll get you on, Ronnie, I'll get you on. And then it's just me and John Stewart in this corner. And so there's this awkward pause. And John Stewart, if we're talking about moving energy and stuff, yeah. John Stewart just goes, so Declan, you're writing with Ronnie. Because that's all he's got to go on. And I go, yeah, we're just writing this pilot. It's about his, like, you know, when he was an international student in Melbourne. He goes, and you just love writing with Ronnie. Like, it's you and Ronnie, you're just writing. It's like, yeah. It's he's awesome. Like, we've had the best time, this pilot. And he goes, yeah, you must love writing with Ronnie. But it's like,
you should have asked if he'd come on the Speakola podcast.
Oh, well, I don't know if you existed yet, technically, yeah. In 2015.
But, no, we might not have. But
but to his credit, then Ronnie's like, okay, and then Ronnie, he didn't want to do the gig. Absolutely, totally understandable. We've been writing all day. He hadn't done a gig in New York yet. And he said to the guy, no, I'm good. And then Ronnie kind of looks at me and goes, come on, we got goal. And I look at, I just see John Stewart and I just go, oh, okay, bye. And he goes, hey, good luck writing with Ronnie.
I think that's going to be the name of your autobiography.
But it was like, I really loved that moment. I was like, oh, this thing where you just go, I might write comedy. You know, you never can plan those steps. I meet Ronnie on problems, you know, he wants to write something later on. He gets The Daily Show. Suddenly you're at this iconic table meeting Jon Stewart. And you have those occasional moments. And writing's a weird one because you know, you don't get the big cheer on stage or whatever. But you just have occasional moments where you go, fuck, I love my life. Yeah. And that was absolutely one of them. Like, it was just like, I just had this smile on my face. Like, it's not, yeah, he would never remember me, John Stewart. But it was just this moment of like, oh, like, I used to watch this show when I was unemployed and I'd have to get DVDs to watch, like, The Daily Show Indecision special from, like, whatever year that came out, like 2000 or something. Yeah. And it's like, now you're here and you're talking to the guy that made it. Well, not really talking. I'm just writing with Ronnie. But yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those, like, it was just one of those good moments.
Well, you mentioned in the speech that we are going to play about a sort of a formative comedy moment. And it's with a friend, another friend of mine well, with Ray Matson and Jason Marion, who put on a show. I think it was a 2000 comedy festival, or 2001,
yeah.
And it was Brian Munich and Friends, masterpiece, still a masterpiece. And you spoke on Willosophy about this show, and it was, for me, it was quite beautiful because I think I was the other guy in every show. Like, I went back over and over to see this amazing production of just, it was bonkers, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a, and I think I'll say what I said in Will, but not as much, but it was a very odd time. We'd put on our first comedy festival show, and it wasn't that we were going to be famous. It was just the people that had been in the Law Review. We just went, let's do a Law Review for the comedy festival, and we did it. But in the week before, my dad passed away, and it ended up being the most unbelievably lucky thing that we had this show, because it gave me something to do every night. And I wasn't going to do it. And then my mum said, I think you should do it. Like, I think it'd be really good for you. If you feel up to it, you should do it. And I did. And it was, all the people in that show were awesome and were unbelievably supportive. And Chris Kennett who I ended up writing with for 10 years and was on Triple R, was the director of that show. Like, they were all great. And it was, mum was right. It gave me something to aim for every night. Like, grief's a weird thing where you walk around and don't know what to do with it, but it gave me something to kind of do. But there was a knock on from it where I would do the show, and then, you know, people would go to the hi-fi and watch stand up. And it was this kind of out of body thing where I was like, I want to do that, but I'm not finding any of this funny. Like, if you've just had that happen and someone's doing observational stand-up about, I went to the shops today, like,
yeah,
I just felt entirely disconnected from it.
And this was a really sudden death, wasn't it?
It was. It was a heart attack while he was driving. Like, it was, early 2001. Yeah, and I was loving doing the show, but then kind of afterwards when people went to watch, you know, Trades Hall was, we were playing at the RMIT Collide Theatre. So Trades Hall was down the road and that had shows on, and we'd go to that, and then, and I'd always just go, and it was this, I remember having a thought, and it's just weird thoughts you have after you die, after someone has died. And if anyone does experience this, like, don't trust those weird thoughts. Like, it's not going to, because I remember thinking, ah, fuck, what if I don't laugh again? Like, I seriously thought, and it's the weirdest thing to be doing a comedy festival show, but to be having that thought, like it was quite an out of body experience. And yeah, but what, it was the last week that we were on, and we went to Trades Hall to watch a friend's show. And I can't remember if we watched it. I think we were late and they wouldn't let us in, or maybe the show was in a smaller room and it sold out, so we didn't get to watch this show. I remember feeling a relief because I don't really want to watch a show. And then we bumped into a different friend who just said, and we said, oh, we didn't get into this show and we'll just probably go to the bar now, because it was later than our show. Our show was like at 7:30 or something. And so we went to Trades Hall afterwards. It was like 10:30 at night. Maybe it was like 10 o'clock. And we saw a guy that we knew, and I just assumed he was doing a show at Trades, and I assumed he was going to try and get us to go to his show because that's what everyone does. But he said, no, I've already performed, but you should see this show, Brian Munich and Friends. And he just said, I saw it the other night. It's one of the wildest things you've ever seen. And we had, you know, you have passes, so you get in for free if they're not sold out. And we just, and I remember thinking, if we get in for free, I'll go, and if we have to pay, I won't. Like, it was, I just thought. And I went, and from the second it started, and you probably feel the same, I remember that show. When you, if you talk about my memory, I can quote most of the show back to you.
Really? Because I wish you that. What were the sketches? The bit, I'm stuck with one little bit that's left for me, because I got a terrible memory.
Yeah.
There's a bit where, out of nowhere, Jason starts screaming, sort of like a heavy metal act.
Yeah.
So he's gone from being a sort of a sleazy game show host. Yeah. To the lighting changing and him screaming the word chalk over and over, which I can't remember why he was screaming chalk.
So it was
chalk.
A Fear Factory song. I know it. It was a Fear Factory song called Shock. And he had heard it somewhere, and it he went, that sounds like chalk. And he thought it would be funny to have a death metal band sing about chalk. And so the start of it goes, well, let's say it's chalk, because that's how you hear it. It just goes, chalk! Chalk! And he holds up a piece of chalk as it happens. He starts writing chalk on the board.
Yeah.
And then, and every time chalk comes on, he looks at the audience with this demonic look on his face, and he just mimes, chalk! And then it finishes, and the other guy in the cast, Ray, comes up, and he goes, Brian, could I just ask you a few questions about chalk? And something about the absurdity of that, and something about the, and I won't quote the whole show, but this is the bit I don't say in the talk because I just didn't want to get into the weeds of a show I'd seen 20 years ago. But you've seen it, and a lot of people that, you know, like comedy have seen it, so I can kind of talk about these things. The first bit of the show I remember is he came out and he sung and the music of Let It Be started.
Yeah.
But he had changed the words, and it was, when I find myself behind a tree, I say, I found me. Now it's your turn to hide. Other me.
Other me. Yeah. I remember Other Me.
And he goes, and then the chorus is, other me, other me, other me, other me. If he is me, then I must be other me. Like... And then he does the final verse, he builds across it, and he goes, and then he handed me the bloody knife as he was running from the murder scene. You've really gone too far this time, other me.
Yeah.
And then it gets to the chorus, other me, if he is me, then I must be other me?
Yeah.
And in that moment, I was just crying with laughter.
And also, you're on the precipice of crying all the time anyway,
exactly.
I gather. Yeah.
And it was the first time I've said this to Jason Marion since, who is still one of the best comedy writers in this and directors in this country. That's the first time I laughed. I remember laughing at that song and like that kind of painful laughter that you do. And there was only about 8 other people in the audience that night. And I think it was a combination. It was taking something that you knew, like Let It Be, and turning it, like kind of cracking the lens on it, or like shifting it so you're seeing it through a completely different, shifting the prism on it so you're seeing it from a completely different angle, and turning it so dark. And I've thought about it since. I didn't know this at the time, but that's how I felt about life. Like, that something kind of quite normal, that everybody's alive and happy. And the morning before my dad died, I remember him saying, what memberships should we get for Hawthorne this year?
Yeah.
Because he goes, maybe we should get the ones with reserve seats in case we make the finals, which Hawthorne did make the preliminary final that year. So he was right. History has vindicated him. And I said, oh, yeah, mate, that's a good idea. I'll check out what the prices are. But let's do that. And that was the last conversation I ever had. And it's like, then that night you find out someone dies. And it's like everything changes in that moment.
You told the story on Willosophy of how you found out. And that blew me away, actually, because I never imagined being a kid facing that sort of thing. And you're not a kid, you're 21, so you're a man. So tell us how you as a young man found out about this tragedy.
So I was, as well as doing comedy, I was playing in a little musical group, and it was not, we were not trying to be, we were just doing covers, and it was, we'd go and do like the bars at uni and get like free beer. Like that was the end game. That was the plan for this. And we would just do covers, and my mate Matt had a great voice and he sung. And then my friend Chris Ryan, who, if anyone's listened to Crossbred, the podcast, is the lead guy in Crossbred, right, and wrote it with me. But Chris has one of the best voices in the country. He's since gone on to, he was the lead in the David Bowie musical and has been the lead in, he was in King Kong, like he's done all sorts of stuff. But we were just doing this for a bit of fun. And we had my mum's house, well, the our house growing up, it was a weird split level kind of 1980s house, late 70s, 80s house, where you kind of had this open space underneath it where there was an office. And then the rest of the, and it was like the little room that was next to the garage. And that was my dad's office for where he worked. And we would rehearse music in there because it was kind of, nobody could hear it because you were kind of like on the bottom of this house and it wouldn't disturb the neighbors. And so, yeah, I remember playing and we were playing a song and it was just one of those ones where when you're rehearsing, it's kind of working. Like Chris was singing well and Matt was playing and doing harmonies. And I just played I was playing the cello because I'd played it at school. And if you're talking about, you know, photographic memories, I just remember like, because you could see down the driveway of our house and it was a kind of like suburban driveway. So it was longish. And I saw two police walking up and I was just like, and my brain first went to, fuck, what have I done? Like, you know, I was at uni that day, like, because your brain is just trying to, but I was still playing music. Like, it was such a weird, like, out of body thing. And then they kind of appeared at the door to this office. Like, it was just like a glass door that you could see through. And they were both standing there. And then my always to this day, when I was a kid, then, now, in a moment of tension, I make jokes. It's just, it's an anxiety thing. It means everybody thinks you know, the life of the party, but it's a complete deflection mechanism. And because we were a band with like a classical, an opera singer, and like me playing cello, and but it's like I knew in that moment something had happened, but my instinct was, it's like, if it's almost like if you crack a joke, like no one were like, it might change the moment or something. And so I remember saying, like, I opened the door and I said, which neighbor complained about the cello? And I said, I bet you know, it's just like how your brain's just zinging. It's like, if I keep making a joke here, they won't get to the shit thing they're going to tell me.
Yeah.
And weirdly, neither my dad nor mum was home. And so my brain was already spiraling. And I was like, was it the old Italian lady over there? She's always, these aren't funny jokes, but they're just you panicking in the moment. And then she said, is anyone else home? And I said, my sister's upstairs. And yeah, Matt and Chris were behind me. And then she said, can we go upstairs? And it's like, it just broke the, you know, and I distinctly remember saying, you're going to tell me something really bad, aren't you? And she goes, can we just go upstairs? And we went upstairs and my sister, you know, she's watching TV and she saw it and I could see her processing it. And I said, Kate, the police are here. I don't know what it is. And then, yeah, the woman, police officer, and she delivered it really, you know, she just said, look, I'm extremely sorry your dad has passed away. It was while he was driving. We don't think it was an accident, like as in we don't think it was a heart attack. It wasn't an accident that kind of, and she said, do you have any support? Is anyone home? And mum didn't have a mobile. And I said, no, we can find mum. I know who she's out with. And then she just said, is there anything you need? Like, she was extremely good at it. The bloke was behind her. I gather maybe she was the senior cop. You know, she's as good at that job that anybody could be. Mm. But then she leaves and they both leave. And as they leave, they walk out and I'm just sitting there with my sister. And like neither of us could say anything. And she's like, fuck, we've got to call mum. And like you're just sitting there. And then I hear the front door open and I assumed it was going to be Matt or Chris to go, are you okay? And the cop walks back in and she goes, oh, sorry, I left my clipboard. And it's like on the table on the other side of my... So she has to like...
Tiptoe back through.
And so I just got to... She then left. Oh. And it's just like I've always had this image of the two cops... I don't remember her holding a clipboard. I think it was the blokes. And I was like, did they rock, paper, scissors outside for who goes back in? Like,
yeah.
And it just, you know, it wasn't until I thought about it years later that I was just like, oh, my God, that happened. And that's the beginning of it kind of thing. But that's the thing. It's like suddenly your normal world has just been completely flipped where cops are tiptoeing back into your house. And so, yeah, seeing Jace's thing, that was the...
This is a week later, right? Or 10 days later.
Yeah, so our show opened a week later and then I probably saw Jace's. I think we were only doing a short run, so I probably saw Jace's a week after that. So it's probably 2 weeks later. And something in that show just had the most profound effect on me. I had not planned to that point to be in comedy, or I just thought it was a fun thing to do with friends. And then suddenly it was like, I have to do this thing. And it... There was just this other thing with Jace's show that you'll probably remember, because he had played... He's got a fascinating story if you ever talk to him. He had played cricket under-19s for Australia. No, for Victoria. He was the leg spinner. Then Warnie turns up and Warnie gets the gig as the leg spinner. And Jace had also played footy for St Kilda and was the backup full forward to Tony Lockett. Yeah. So both times he gets beaten by the person who's the best thing at that thing in history. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there was always this like his thing of Australian sport. And this again comes, it's funny we started with sport and art. It comes back to the sport and art thing, because in this show, like he suddenly just goes, oh, now he transformed into Bruce McAvaney and he goes, I'd like to read a poem from my book. And Bruce McAvaney's reading a poem. Yeah. I still remember. I don't remember the whole poem, but the poem was called Seamen of Black. But the idea that Bruce McAvaney writes these really dark, fucked up poems that deeply appealed to me because, again, everything had flipped.
Yeah.
And then he has this other one where Richie Beno comes out, and Richie Beno is the world yo-yo champ.
Yeah.
It's his secret thing that he's good at that he hasn't told anyone. And Richie Beno was still alive at the time. And he does this yo-yo thing as Richie Beno. And I was crying with laughter because it was all these things that were very iconic and normal to me that I would watch cricket and footy with my dad and Bruce McAvaney, and suddenly they'd been completely tilted and shown in a completely kind of beautiful, fucked up way. And it also made me go, it was the biggest relief because I just went, I can laugh again. Like, yeah. I know that sounds like so, like, but it really, that's how I felt. And then, as you've said, they then won a couple of nights later the best show in the Melbourne Comedy Festival for a show that was very obscure and no one knew. They beat everybody. And then they also won the Age Critics. And because of that, they extended the season and they kept adding a week, another week.
Yeah. That's when I think I saw it because I saw it with Reasonable Houses. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's what, and I kept going back and the booking number, this is when it was before even websites, was Jason Marion's phone number. And so I rang and he answered, the guy that I'd seen and that I thought, fuck, he's saved my life. And I said, oh, I'm booking for five friends. This is like the fourth time we went back. And then he said, have you been before? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I recognize your voice. Did you leave a message? And I was like, yeah. And then he said, I'll just give you free tickets because you've just come back. And he goes, say hello after the show. And so I did. And then I remember it clearly at this little room at Trades Hall, and I waited outside the door. And I just said, how did you do this? How did you get into this? And then he goes, I'd love to answer this, but I've got to leave. And then he said, but you know my number because it's the booking number. And give me a call and we can talk about comedy. And that was the beginning of that. And he kind of unofficially mentored me. Like I would send him stuff that I'd written for the next few years. And he then directed the last ever comedy festival show I ever did in 2005 with Chris Kennett and Chris Mildren. And then we kind of just made mates and we would talk about footy, or, you know, but in this kind of, you know, weird way. And then in 2007, he got the head writer job at Rove and he said, do you want to write for Rove? And that was all from that one moment of a guy saying, do you want to, you know, you should go and watch this show. Yeah.
Well, Declan, probably unlike any other guest, I've really just steered you from story to story, like you're on the phone with me, and you've given me almost no insight into the speech that we're about to listen to. So we could quickly do it. Did you write it or just ad-lib it?
I did. They wanted a very particular speech. They wanted it to be lighthearted. I'm finding a lot at the moment, schools post-COVID and, you know, they don't want it to be heavy. So I have done a version where I've talked about my dad passing away and then, you know, comedy being a kind of savior. But and it's not that the school was negative about it. I didn't even talk to them about it. They just said, hey, could you give us about 15 minutes, really positive, uplifting speech? And, you know, she said, look, we want to look ahead. Like, what can the kids think of next? And then that was kind of, and so that's kind of how I wrote it. The only bit that was an old story in it was the story about the audition and it going kind of wrong, which you'll hear in the thing, which is true. That is exactly what happened at that audition that I went to. And it's funny when I only listened back to it because I had to send it to you and make sure the sound was okay. It's an older bit of the speech, whereas everything else has been written written for it. And it's kind of like a slightly odd key change in the middle. Like I can hear myself shift from a particular rhythm to what's more of a kind of like anecdote that I've told at schools like a lot of times.
But I think it needed it. So because the speech starts with, I think, strong jokes.
Yeah.
But it's a series of kind of gags, like lines.
Yeah.
And as we go into the back half of the speech, you're going to do more wisdom, like some one-line wisdom. A bit like I was thinking of Tim Minchin's famous speech in University of WA, where he gives 9 pieces of wisdom and you give 3 or 4 pieces of wisdom.
Yeah.
But it's a really nice buffer between the two stages to have the story of the audition, and and it's just a yarn like we've had in this chat.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. It just felt odd because my brain was going, as I was doing it, oh, thank God the new stuff's working, because I really didn't have much to do in the lead up to that talk, and I thought, I'm going to write a new opening for this because she's asked for a very particular thing. She wants it to be really positive and uplifting, and so all of the new opening up until that audition is kind of the first time that I've done it. And then ironically, I've only just thought of it now, because you write something, you think it's okay, and then like a day before you get really worried. I'm sure you look at your stuff and you go, oh, it's all shit. And I rang Jason Marion and I said, Brian Munich, I rang him and said, could I just show you, you don't have to read the whole thing, I've just written an entirely new kind of opening 5 or 6 minutes. And he rang back and he read it and he rang back straight away and he goes, I really like how you open it. And he just suggested one other joke that's in there. I think it's the Bluetooth joke. I had kind of one that didn't quite land earlier. And he goes, oh, you know, Bluetooth. He goes, I always think of that time and like, you know, for a while people got Bluetooth and you'd think they were just talking to themselves, but they were on a call. Yeah. And I was like, I just went, oh, yeah, I'll put that in, that kind of.
Imagine if he had it done as Brian Munich. Imagine if he had it done as 2000s Brian Munich.
Yeah, it might have been a bit too dark for them. And that's partly why I decided to reference him in it and keep that moment in, because I was like, you don't know when you're young that one conversation you have or that one, you know, you said before we were talking, or maybe you said it on this, that your thing to do the review at your law thing. You don't know often when you're younger that you're making a big choice. You don't know that this tiny thing could knock onto something massive. And there's not in a million years did I think, in all the grief books, nobody says, go to your mate's show, be late, go, and then have to go to a different show and have that show reflect exactly how you feel about the world, and then decide to be inspired to be a comedy writer and have that guy give you a job 6 years later. Like, not in a million grief books, but I think what it shows me is that everybody's got to have their own path to... Yeah.
Yeah, I love your path, Declan. Often you tell me what project you're on, and sometimes the project will materialise. Crossbred, one of the funniest podcasts ever made in Australia, should be a syndicated series. I hope so for you.
It should be, and I'm slightly annoyed that it isn't, but that's a story for it. Yet. That's a story for another day.
And you're telling me about one that's popped up that has disability themes that just, to me, sounded like it was absolutely hilarious. And I've got my fingers crossed absolutely for that one as well.
Yeah.
But you're a man who jumps from interesting project to interesting project. You're better at finding people to collaborate with than me. I'm sad and lonely.
I'm collaborating with you now. Like, we all, in the lockdowns, we would call each other, maybe after a few drinks, we should do something together. Yeah. It's taken a little while, but we're collaborating now.
And long may you keep telling stories, Declan. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, mate.
Speakola.
Thank you, Declan Fay. And you can book him to speak at your school through Booked Out. You can also book me through Booked Out. I do school visits as well. Talk about writing books, book week talks, this sort of thing. Or you can book me to do corporate MC work either directly at tony@tonywilson.com.au or at ICMI. Declan is a lifelong Hawthorne supporter and we share that love of the brown and gold, struggling a little early in the season in 2024. But I put up a three-parter about my love affair with Hawthorne on Good One Wilson, a place where I gather my writing past and present. And if you want to check that out, it's just look up Good One Wilson. And again, you can sign up for free. The speech of the week is the Eltham High valedictory. Played a snippet at the outset. As he said in our chat, it's not really representative of the vast majority of school speaking that Declan's done over the years, but it's funny, it's self-contained, and we have a recording, and so I'm going to play it. So here it is, Declan Fay at Eltham High in December of 2023.
Thank you, teachers, parents, students, and younger siblings who really wish they were at home playing Fortnite right now. You are probably sitting there with a lot of questions right now. What score will I get for VCE? What will I do next year? Why is this slightly overweight, balding comedy writer speaking to us when Cadell Evans went to our school? Cadell may have won the Tour de France, but has he ever written a joke that resulted in the head of the ABC having to apologise to the Senate Estimates Inquiry? I really want to tell you that joke, but I can't because your school hasn't paid me yet and I need the money. Sorry, it's always, I'd never looked at that picture before I got up. It's always alarming when there's a picture of you 10 years ago before the lockdowns made you add 400 kilograms. That's quite a thing to have looming over my... Look at the joy. Anyway, I finished school in 1997. It was a time before the internet, when if you really liked someone, you couldn't just Google a picture of them. It was a time before Bluetooth, when people on the street who looked like they were talking to themselves were actually talking to themselves. And it was a time when mobile phones were the size of a house brick, so very few people had them. Kids definitely didn't have them. So, if you liked someone, you had to find their number in a giant book, hope you had the right house, triangulate where they might live, then call the house, speak to their actual parents, and beg to speak with their child. Then, if they weren't there, you had to leave a message and hope they called back when you were still at home. To organise one date, it could take 3 months and a series of panic attacks. As I said, I finished school in 1997. And like some of you, I imagine, in this audience, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I did the one course you do when you don't know what you want to do. It's an arts degree. That's really frightening how many people knew that before I said it. I didn't even know what arts was. I just knew I liked some of the subjects, and there was a subject where all you had to do was watch movies. I remember when I told my dad I wanted to do arts, he looked at me like I just dragged a dead animal into the lounge room. He said, but why don't you do something else? Why don't you be a vet? Now, this was extremely strange because I had no interest in being a vet. I hadn't even done any of the subjects that you needed to be a vet. The total extent of my experience with animals was our cat, and I didn't even like our cat. I still don't like cats. They are extremely arrogant and aloof. It turns out my dad wanted to be a vet, and he hadn't done it, so now he wanted me to do it. Now, my intention here, quite seriously, was not to teach any lessons. You've all finished school and you've been taught enough lessons for this year and the last 6 years. So what I will do is give pieces of potentially helpful advice that you can take or leave. So my first piece of advice that you can take or leave is please don't do something after this because someone else wants you to do it. You won't be happy and then you won't do it well and then you'll resent them and it'll make Christmas really awkward every year. And I know this because I come from a family of Irish people who never discuss their feelings until they drink too much. So I know all about awkward family Christmases. In fact, my second piece of helpful advice is if you find yourself at an Irish Christmas, the second they crack out the whiskey and start singing Danny Boy, get the hell out of there. I started the arts degree and I actually wasn't really enjoying it. The subjects were good, but you turn up and you do one class in a massive lecture theatre like this, and then you leave and you never see those people for another week. And it was actually kind of lonely. But then one day I was walking out of the uni and I saw a sign which said, "Do you think you're funny?" It was auditions for a comedy show at the university that I'm sure some of you would know. It was called the Melbourne University Law Review. On a whim, I decided to do the audition. And I wasn't a confident performer. I was absolutely terrified. And the first thing we had to do was stand in a circle, introduce ourselves and tell a funny story. The first two people before me were very funny and it gets to my turn to speak and I just completely froze. It was like my brain short-circuited and I tried to speak but that bit that kind of connects your brain to your mouth just broke and I just went... and they looked at me like, is this guy all right or... And I tried to speak again, and I remember my cheeks went red, and I started to sweat, and I just went... And they looked at me like, is this guy constipated or some kind of bowel problem? And so I did what any mature person would do when they've embarrassed themselves in front of a group of people. I ran out of the room, and I left, and I just panicked, and I ran down the corridor, and I ran straight into the bathroom. And I ran over to the mirror. And I just thought to myself, if I don't go back into that room, I don't think I'll ever audition for a comedy show again. And then I thought to myself, you've just made the strangest amount of noises in front of a group full of people. You've pretty much hit rock bottom. You might as well just go back into the room. You've got nothing to lose. And so I decided to go back in. And they were on to the next bit where everybody had to pair up with something and do something funny. And I got paired up with a young guy who was in that group, and he's very confident. And I was the last person to get a pair because I think most people think, I don't want to be with that weird, sweaty guy that's just emitting random sounds in the corner. But I get this guy, and we were kind of panicking and not knowing what to do, and we couldn't work anything out. And before we'd kind of planned it, the director called us up on stage to do something. And again, I just completely froze. And I looked at this guy, what do we do? And he said, just do something when we get up there. And I just froze. And this guy looks at me and he just goes, do something, you've got to do something. And to this day, I don't know why I did this. But sometimes when you panic, you just do the first thing that comes into your brain. And I looked at this guy and I looked around the room and I just went, ah! And this guy looked at me like, what are you doing? And I went, I don't know. But I was stuck standing there like some sort of crippled animal that had just been shot with a poison dart. And this guy, then he must have panicked because he looked at me and then all of a sudden he went, ah! And he did the same thing. And I mean, this guy was a professional actor, so I've managed to drag him down to my level. But then something very strange happened because then he did that, so I panicked and I started to squawk, and then he started to squawk, and before you knew it, we were two 20-year-old guys dancing around that room like two animals doing some very sick mating dance. And it gets to the end and nobody was laughing. If anything, people were just a bit frightened. And this guy walks off and he just left me standing there, and I was just frozen. It was like my feet were just nailed to the ground. And thank God, this one girl in the back corner of the room who was in the audition just went, did one of those laughs that sounds like your brain's trying to get out your nose. And then that caught on to the guy next to her, and he kind of went, and thank God the girl sitting next to him had one of those really embarrassing laughs where she went, and after that it was on, because everyone knows the snort laugh is the worst laugh. If you do that at a party, just call a taxi and go home. But it had the right effect, because everybody started to laugh. It just washed across the room. Every single person started to laugh. I started to laugh. And in that moment, it was like I realised everybody in that room was nervous. You always think it's just you that's nervous, but everybody is nervous when they want to achieve something. It's just everybody has different ways of showing it. Some people get really, really loud and crazy. Some people get really, really quiet and soft. Some people flap their arms and squawk like a psychopath. But it was in that moment when everybody laughed that I just stopped worrying about what everybody thought. And I thought, I've got nothing left to lose here. And it was like something just shifted in my brain. And to me, the power of a big laugh or people laughing is like it can change the energy of the room. It can change the worst moment of your life into one of the funniest moments of your life. And for the rest of the audition, I was just like a different person. I didn't care. I wasn't nervous. And it got to the end, and they said they would give us a call in the next few days and let us know if we got in. And I got a phone call a few days later, and I got in. And as soon as I went to the first rehearsal, I found the place that I fitted in. It's kind of hard to explain what that place is, but you may have found it. You may find it next year, or you may find it a couple of years down the track. But you know it when you find it. Whatever that thing is you do, you feel excited to get there, you like being there, and you don't want to leave. Which brings me to my next piece of helpful advice that you can take or leave, which is whatever you do after this, there'll be moments that you massively stuff up. But don't give up, and don't do what I did and just run out of the room. Because way too many people give up the first time something goes wrong and then never try again. I've thought about that so many times and thought, if I didn't go back, maybe I wouldn't have ended up in writing or radio or comedy. And I've realised that the stuff-ups are often the best stories, and they're often the best chances to learn, and they're often the funniest stories down the track. It just doesn't feel like that at the time. So we did that show. It was one of the best experiences of my life. And one night somebody in that show said we should go to a show at the comedy festival. But we got there and everything was sold out. But there was one show at 10:30 at night that still had seats. And it was a show I don't think any of you would know because it was over 20 years ago. It was a show called Brian Munich and Friends. I can't really explain it, because trying to explain why something funny to you is very hard, but it was simply one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And there was just this moment as I was watching it where I thought, that is exactly what I want to do. And so when the show finished, I said to my friends, I'll meet you in the bar. I didn't tell them what I was doing. And I waited outside the door of the theatre, and I waited till the main guy from the show came out, and I was so nervous, and I just said, that's the best show I've ever seen. And then I said, how do you become a comedy writer? And he said, just keep writing every day. And then he gave me his number, and he said to call if I ever wanted to talk about comedy. So I took his advice. And so I would go to a local cafe, and I'd buy one coffee, and I would just look at all the newspapers and try to write jokes or funny stories or stupid ideas or anything, basically until they started to give me weird looks for only buying one coffee in 6 hours. I stayed in touch with Jason, and I kept... Oh, that was his name, the guy that helped me. And I kept sending him stuff, and 5 years later, I got a phone call from him, and he was the new head writer of, at the time, the biggest show on TV, a show called Rove. And he asked me if I wanted to write for the show. And that was how I got my first comedy writing job, and I've been working as a comedy writer ever since. So, here's a list of helpful suggestions you can take or leave out of that. If you ever see anything you like on stage or someone playing music or anything, you always think, oh, they won't want me to come up. They really want you to come up. Well, most of them do. Some of them don't. You just make sure you pick it right. But most of them do, because most of them are needy and insecure performers who need your affirmation. But the non-joke version of that is most people make art or make comedy or make anything because they want to connect to people. The second one is, don't be afraid to ask questions. How did you get into this? How did you come up with that? Because these days you can Google pretty much how to do anything. But what I've realised is nothing beats going up and asking someone for advice. Nothing beats the actual human connection. Google won't ever be the head writer of a comedy show and offer you a job. At least I really hope not. The final piece of advice out of that is, just keep working on your thing. Even if you don't have a job in the area, keep practicing, keep doing it, so when the opportunity comes along, you'll be ready. I think back to the moment where I saw that poster on the wall for the auditions, or the moment when I waited outside the comedy show. There will be a moment sometime in the next few years when something catches your eye. It could be a poster for an audition, a person in class, a show you go to, something you see online. But don't be afraid to trust that moment, or to take that detour, or to go up to the person who has inspired you, because you have no idea where it will take you. Maybe it'll be a good conversation, or maybe it will be a whole other chapter to your story. I've written a lot of shows now, but whenever you finish writing something, whether it's an episode or a series or a comedy festival show, you're exhausted. It's kind of a little bit like some of you might feel now. You probably don't even want to think what the next thing is. But there is a moment when you do have to write the next thing. There is a moment when you open your laptop and you stare at the blank page. And it is the single most thrilling, terrifying thing, because you can put anything on it and you can tell any story you want. And for the last few years, you've all written a story for yourself. Some of you will have loved the story. Some of you might not have loved it. Some of you might just be glad that it's over. But when you started at school, you probably weren't in control of that story. Your parents might have chosen the school, or the teachers might have encouraged you to do subjects, or friends might have told you to do a particular subject. But now all of you have a blank page, and you can fill it with any story you want. And it doesn't have to be perfect straight away. The first episode of the show that somebody mentioned before, Ronnie Cheng, International Student, had 32 different drafts, and I still look at it and still reckon it could be better. But the important thing is that you tell the story only you can tell, and make it a story that you can be proud of. And finally, be very grateful and nice to your parents, because if you really, really want to live your dream, one day you will need to borrow money off them. Houses are not getting cheaper. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for letting me share my story with you. Thanks a lot.
That's it for the episode. Thank you so much, Declan Fay. Certainly, you've got to listen to Crossbred. It's such a funny podcast with Megan Washington and Chris Ryan, and the music in it is just excellent. Declan is a fanatic of the Wu-Tang Clan and 90s rap generally, and he has brought his A-game to Crossbred. You've got to listen to that. Also, he wrote Ronnie Cheng, International Student. I think you can still find that on iView. Thanks everyone who's subscribed to Speakola through either the Patreon, patreon.com/Speakola, or the Substack newsletter, that's news.speakola.com. If you've got a good suggestion for a Speakola guest, you know someone who's delivered a good speech or is a good talker generally, and we can find a speech to fit around them, I'm always on the lookout. So help me out with suggestions, tony@tonywilson.com.au. That's it for this episode. Spread the Speakola word. All speeches, great and small. Until next time, speak well.